Like many of you, I too am looking forward to the last couple days of 2020. It has been a rough year. Hope you and your loved ones are well and safe. This is Tom Dotan, reporter here at The Information. At our year-end episode, we thought we should take the time to think about the year that just happened and the year looking ahead. We have this annual tradition at The Information of predictions. We like to use our reporting powers to think about what's going to change in the industry that we cover. And joining me to discuss these is Corey Weinberg. Hey, Corey.
Hello, hello.
So the whole prediction racket that we run here, it's an interesting one because just as a little inside look, it one gives us an opportunity to, you know, prepare for the year ahead in terms of what stories we want to be reporting and writing about, but also, you know, gives us a chance to say, well, we weren't able to confirm this really hot tip that we had or trend in the industry, so let's make a prediction around it and see if we can get it out there that way. That's been my strategy. What about you?
Yeah, I don't think prediction making is like the most comfortable place for reporters to be. You know, some reporters are maybe enjoy it. I know some folks on our staff like really love making predictions, but for me and I know for some of my other colleagues, it's a little uncomfortable. You're kind of always looking to sort of uncover what's happening in the here and now, not like using predictive powers to figure out what's going to happen to the future. But I don't know. I've kind of come around on it. You know, it trains your mind to like actually think about what's going to be important on your beat next year. So, you know, like I think people get value out of it.
Yeah. And full transparency for us, what we did this year is we also looked back at our predictions and graded how successful they were. Some of mine on the media beat were not bad. I talked about Disney becoming this huge streaming service and its trajectory clearly matched that. I also thought that Apple wouldn't do as well, that I think they ended up doing a little bit better than I may have thought. My colleague Jessica Tungle nailed it, although unintentionally maybe, when she thought that we were about to see big studios potentially not release as many of their movies in theaters and go direct to streaming. She didn't predict the pandemic, but clearly that played a big part in it.
That was the thing about this year's, like, grading last year's predictions. They were so weird. How could you have foreseen a pandemic?
So in this episode, I spoke with Jessica Tunkle, Nostradamus of movie release schedules, and Martin Pierce, our editor on the Media Beat. And we kind of broke down why this year ended up being so incredibly disruptive to all of the big traditional media companies and the streamers, and saw, you know, whether 2021 was going to be a continuation of what we saw this year or a reversion to the mean. And yeah, I mean, Corey, you spoke with Kate and Zoe, I believe, to talk about investing.
Yeah, we talked about venture capital and startups and what those two reporters who cover that area, what they think is going to happen in 2021. It's obviously kind of an investment frenzy right now. IPOs are popping, so late stage startups are seeing price increases. So we talked about who we thought would go public and where we think startups are going to relocate, stuff like that.
Let's start off with my conversation with Martin and Tunkle. So I've got Martin Pierce and Jessica Tunkle, the full media team, here with me to discuss the media predictions, which, in my opinion, is always the most interesting predictions that The Information puts out, because I contribute to it, but also because it seems like we're in a period where so much is changing. I mean, Martin, I want to start with you here, just in giving an overall perspective, because, you know, you've been covering the space since, you know, Louis Mayer and that whole crew. So many unprecedented things in general about 2020, but a year in which there was so much disruption and change in the traditional media model as what happened this year in terms of, you know, the deceleration of people subscribing to cable or, you know, certainly the movie windows. I mean, have you ever seen anything like it?
No, I think this is the classic example of where you have, you know, trends that are moving very slowly, and then some major event comes along and sort of forces a very abrupt speed up of those trends. And that's obviously what the pandemic did.
Yeah, we can talk about that in a bit. But I mean, on that point, you know, Tunkle, you probably made the strongest prediction that we had last year, unwittingly perhaps, in thinking, or maybe you knew things that we didn't, I don't know, about the theatrical window. And you had predicted at the end of 2019 that there were going to be a couple of movie studios that maybe shortened or eliminated altogether the theatrical window. Boy, you kind of hit the nail on the head on that one.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I didn't know that there was going to be a global pandemic, but...
Okay, good. Thank you for clarifying that.
You know, I think that there was a lot of thought that even AT&T seemed to be talking a lot about disrupting things. They're not a traditional Hollywood company. They'd bought Time Warner. There was a lot of belief that they actually would be, if someone was going to do it, they might be the first to do it. They weren't the first to do it. I mean, I think Universal actually was the first to do it with Trolls, but obviously Warner Media made the most drastic move by taking its entire 21 slate and putting it out on HBO Max at the same time as theaters.
Why do you think it ended up being Warner Media and AT&T that was the most drastic about all of this? I mean, they all have streaming services. They're all reliant on the theatrical industry to a degree because they release expensive movies in theaters. I mean, what was it about them that made you think that they were going to be the ones to do it?
I mean, they're not Hollywood insiders, right? They haven't grown up in this industry. They aren't, they haven't lived by these like boundaries. And Jason Kilar, you know, the new CEO of Warner Media, I mean, that's his whole MO, right? You know, when he was at Hulu, he was all about, you know, kind of changing the model. And his whole mantra is being direct to consumer and doing what's best for consumers. And I've had a lot of debate about this week, about whether this move is best for consumers or just best for HBO.
Can I just ask, who would debate whether this was best for consumers?
So, I mean, I was talking to someone yesterday who was making the point that, like, you know, people on the East Coast and West Coast watch HBO and they'll pay the $15 a month for HBO Max. But, like, people in Middle America still want to go to the theaters and there are still theaters open.
But hang on a second. I actually think that what Warner did made perfect sense. They, you know, there's quite a few theaters that aren't open. So why wouldn't you say for this one period of time, we're going to allow the movies to be on in the theaters and on streaming just during the pandemic? Why is it such a, you know, why are people acting like the world has ended?
I mean, I think the real answer to that, I mean, I totally agree with you, but I think the real answer to that is people are upset that they didn't give them a heads up, right? Like, that's why they're upset.
Well, Martin, actually, you're very opinionate about this, and you and I have gotten into debates about whether or not this is a long-term change. I mean, you sort of hit on that earlier, but it sounds to me like you're saying it's really impossible to say whether this is going to mean a secular shift for the movie industry at large, and even for Warner Media, that you think it's just a one-year attempt.
Well, I think the bottom line is that the studios cannot afford to put everything onto streaming and not have them in theaters. They simply cannot afford it.
But you've been critical for a long time, or when I first, you know, you and I first started working together covering media, about the slowness of the entertainment industry to embrace things like putting premium video, you know, rentals, making rentals available sooner than they normally do, maybe at a higher price point. I mean, you feel like that was a very anti-consumer move that studios had to at least not give people the opportunity to rent these things at an earlier point, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, I don't think that these things are contradictory. I think that you should give people more choice in how they see the movies. But that doesn't mean that if you put it on streaming and in the theaters that you are ending the theaters. I mean, the theaters maybe have to work harder to get people to actually, visit them, which some are actually doing. But I really don't believe that people want to spend their entire time sitting at home and never actually go out. You know, work from home and also enjoy all of their entertainment and eating at home. It's not how people are. So I think there's been a major overreaction to all of this.
Getting out of the house, not with your kids, sounds nice. And going to a theater where you can have like dinner and a movie in the same place, like an Alamo Drafthouse experience.
Exactly.
Sounds very appealing to me. I don't know about you, Tinkle.
Some people think that, like, will Hollywood abandon Warner Media because of this? Like, have they killed those relationships?
No, I'm sure that they're all upset. And as Tom mentioned, they're annoyed that they didn't get some sort of, you know, advance warning. But Warner is such a major studio. Once this evolves and once they see that Warner is still committed to theaters, I think that they will calm down.
Well, I mean, the interesting argument here, and that kind of leads into the next set of predictions, is one person, the argument they were making to me is that if Warner Media is in this situation where they're releasing some movies in a theater, some direct to streaming, they're kind of in the same boat at this point as almost every service out there. I mean, Netflix also, even though they're primarily a streaming service, does release some stuff into theaters. Apple does it as well. I mean, do you, for, you know, anticipate that you're going to see a lot more competition from, you know, quote unquote, streaming services, Netflix and Apple, to get big movies and kind of adopt a somewhat similar release pattern as what a traditional studio would have done?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, I mean, if you remember, the majority of HBO's digital viewing before, and I think linear viewing too, before HBO Max, before AT&T bought it, was movies. You know, viewers a lot of the time are watching movies on these services, and you kind of forget about that because, you know, when people are talking about Netflix, they're talking about the latest show and this and that. But I think Apple is going to realizing, you know, they have this very curated approach to their originals, but I think they're also realizing that they need to step up their library, and movies are going to be a way of doing that.
Tunkel, what about, you had a pretty bold prediction about, back to Warner Media and CNN. We haven't talked as much about the TV and cable business on this, but you, what, are you getting a sense that Warner Media might cut itself off from CNN and sell off its cable networks? I mean, it's a pretty bold move. I don't know. Is that like reflective of the Trump era ending and people just don't care as much about cable news anymore? Why would they get rid of CNN?
I just think that if you think that cable news ratings have hit their peak, which I think they have, it would be a good time to sell. There's been a lot of chatter in private equity and investor circles about, you know, could there be some way to do something with CNN and spin it off?
But let's agree also that regardless of whether or not they sell CNN, they will end up selling the entire entertainment business at some point in the next 5 years.
I go three years.
2022 or 2023.
2022, AT&T says, we got to cut bait. This didn't work out. You know, John Stankey and Randall, you messed up. So, well, what happens at that point, too? I mean, we can just spend like a minute or so on this, but like in a world which you're saying is not next year, but in a world in which AT&T says, fuck it, and they sell it, and then, you know, maybe Comcast feels the same way. I mean, what happens to these companies? They're still huge producers of content. They still have, you know, deals with the biggest talent in Hollywood. I mean, what do you do in a world where you're not Disney and you're not owned by a big telephone or telecom?
Well, my suggestion is that Netflix buys Warner.
Wow, that's a big one. And does Apple buy any of them? Or?
Apple, yeah. Well, if that happened, then maybe Apple would buy NBC Universal.
Last thing, any movie recommendations for people over the holidays, things you've seen that you think are worth checking out? It doesn't have to be movies, series too.
Spiral is fantastic.
What is Spiral?
Paris police and judicial drama. It's really good.
All right. I recommend people watch Tenet, and then we can debate it later at a different podcast. What a weird movie. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Okay. Bye. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
What does 2021 have in store for venture capital and startups? I brought in two of our experts who can talk about their predictions for the VC and startup market, Kay Clark and Zoe Bernard, both reporters at The Information. Thanks for coming on the 411.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Corey.
All right. You guys did 6 predictions. I want to run through them and we can debate them. Or first one, I think, Kate, this was yours, a fintech prediction. You thought that Chime and Klarna will go public, as well as Robinhood. Why do you think these fintech names are gonna go public?
I mean, we saw a record amount of investment in fintech in 2020, and I think a lot of people are expecting, due to just the rise of direct listings and SPACs and, you know, the narrative shift around the public markets, that we're going to see just a lot of exits in general. I think a lot of fintech companies are reaching that age where they are considering very seriously going public. You know, you mentioned Robinhood. Others like Chime have made comments that they are prepping. They are thinking about it. It's definitely going to happen, you know, next year or two. So yeah, I think it's less specifically about these companies and more just that I see a wave of fintech exits, both particularly SPACs due to, you know, a number of venture firms that are setting up SPACs, Ribbit Capital being one fintech-focused firm that's launched a SPAC and planning to acquire a company soon.
It's interesting that I think you might have the Robin Hood effect on companies like Robin Hood and some of these other consumer fintech names.
Yeah, I think it'll be really, really interesting to see Robin Hood's IPO. Like you just said, the Robin Hood effect, we're seeing a lot of retail investors buy into IPOs because they're using the Robin Hood app and they're bored at home and they're spending a lot of time on there. And I think we will see probably a huge, that's what, you know, partially why we're seeing these massive pops. But yeah, some of these consumer fintech companies like Chime, like Robinhood, that are brands that people really know, those are going to be really, really huge IPOs, I'm sure.
And just briefly, just to expand a little bit on that, how do you explain why VCs have been so hot on and companies like Chime and Klarna, and maybe you can explain just a little bit what they do. But now that public investors might be kind of looking at them, why have they sort of gotten traction from VC so far?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long time coming for the fintech category. You know, a lot of these companies have been around a long time and they just weren't really able to raise much money and they weren't considered to be, you know, a quote unquote sexy area of investment. Chime is a neobank, a challenger bank, a digital banking startup that struggled for years to raise capital. And what happened was partially COVID just really, really changed how consumers view some of these financial services. And as a result, you know, these companies are growing like crazy and their revenue growth is pretty astonishing. And I think, to answer your question, I think it's really just multiple things, the maturation of the sector and then COVID just pushing it forward like 5-10 years.
Well, in terms of blockbuster IPOs, we've already seen, Zoe, you wrote that you expect to see the creation of even more early stage funds started by this newly minted cohort of tech millionaires from DoorDash and Airbnb. Why do you think that? Aside from maybe the obvious of, okay, these people are going to have more money to play around with now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we've just seen that so many times in the past, right? Like we have like PayPal Mafia or like just the number of startups that were founded by, former Uber executives that go out and they fuel this new wave of innovation. And I think DoorDash, Airbnb, these are massive IPOs and there's so much wealth that's been generated. And where are these people going to put their money? They're going to invest it in innovation and tech and ideas that they think are going to be important. I think we're going to see a ton of angel investors, but I think more so, I just feel like there's such a spike in early stage funds and seeing maybe execs at DoorDash and Airbnb wanting to go rogue and start early stage funds seems like it could be in the cards.
Yeah, it'll be fun to watch. I mean, I was just struck by still how much influence those ex-PayPal guys have and how much more power they are gaining. Just, I did the math on all the Airbnb investors who won in terms of VCs from this IPO. And like, God, Keith Raboy, Reid Hoffman, Peter Thiel, like it's just, these guys are all PayPal. And I don't know. I wonder what will cause like a newer company to actually have that same track record of success. I wonder what like the secret ingredient is there.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have all these people who've just been involved in the creation of like these rocket ship companies and they're eager to experience that again, maybe like at a sort of a remove. And they just have so much experience that to go into advising promising founders just seems like a very exciting opportunity for them.
Kate, you wrote that as drug companies distribute coronavirus vaccines next year, VCs are going to turn their attention away from sectors like remote work and virtual learning and back towards areas that were hot before the pandemic, like hospitality and real estate tech.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really more just that people are asking me, if we have a vaccine, if we're all going back to normal, whatever that is, are investors going to be spending as much of their cash on remote work software, on ed tech, on virtual tools that enable virtual existence. And I do think there still will be a lot of investment there. I just think in addition, you're going to see other areas that were a little bit left behind start to recover. And I think those are those are areas like hospitality, travel. Areas like real estate, things that sort of we relied upon in a normal pre-COVID universe that will come back. And I think we're going to start to see that. And I think in the second half of next year.
Okay. Well, Zoe, you wrote that remote-only startups will become the norm, not just more popular, but the norm, and that startups aren't going to lease office space anymore. I'm a little skeptical.
I think that companies that are founded in this remote-only era, they have this huge advantage in that they're not paying for super expensive office space in a very expensive city like San Francisco, and they can hire from anywhere in the world. So they can bring in even more competitive talent. So I think that investors are just like, they're really not going to care about whether or not a team has an office. And they might even encourage founders to stay remote if they can do it.
Here's what I think, like, it takes management that is like super refined and thoughtful in order to make remote only work, like with no offices. And most startups, I think, as we know, have like crappy management. Like, they just, like, it's so on the fly. I think it would be really difficult to make companies gel with no offices at all. So my bet is that I think you're right. I think there'll be more remote only startups. I just don't know if it's going to be the norm. All right, guys. Well, thanks so much for coming on the 411, and we'll chat next year about how these predictions played out.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks, Corey.
All right, everybody, that's this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening. As always, thank you to our guests, Martin Pierce, Jessica Tunkel, and with Corey Weinberg, Zoe Bernard, and Kate Clark, Ariella Markowitz for producing, and see you back here next week.